Our producer, Mel, gave me this interesting insight when we were preparing for the interview. She said, now with the circular economy, it's possible that my mayo jar might suddenly show up as my shampoo bottle, or my paper cup could be my new shoebox. That's possible, right?
Absolutely. You throw a PET bottle into the recycle bin, and we bale that. A one-ton bale of those PET bottles is worth literally over $1,000. There's people paying thousands of dollars for that content. And we can chip it. So literally, your pop bottle could end up being the t-shirt you wear tomorrow.
When we think about high tech, we think about medicine, perhaps autonomous vehicles or space exploration. What if I told you that technology plays a huge role in the garbage industry? Really, that's true. We have Aaron Johnson on the podcast today to talk some high tech trash. He is Area Vice President for the Great Lakes region with Waste Management. Aaron, welcome to Life Meet Tech.
Thank you so much, Prabhu. It's a pleasure to be here.
You have a very interesting backstory, and I've seen a fun YouTube clip that talks about you as a fourth generation garbage man, and you're proud of it. What's the story behind that?
My great-grandfather started a business in Northwest Indiana back in 1958, and you know, it was a small business, grew over time. My father got into the business. My grandfather was killed in a garbage truck accident. In 1993, I was 12 years old. Literally the next day, my dad took over the business, but it also got me into the business at 12. It put me into the maintenance shop, sweeping floors, changing tires. At 14, it put me on the back of a garbage truck, collecting on my days off, weekends, summer breaks, Christmas breaks. At 18, I was so proud when I got my CDL license. And then I started driving trash trucks and earning a little bit of money. I entered business school and they're like, what are your goals? What do you want to be when you grow up kind of stuff? And it's like, I want to be a professional garbage man. I don't think anybody knew what that meant, but that's what I wanted. 3 months after I graduate school, my dad sells the company to WM. I've now been here 19 years. It's been a wonderful journey. And, you know, I'm living my dream. They moved me to the Great Lakes area where I was born and raised. I'm the area president over three states and in a region where I grew up. And literally, I'm living my dream right now.
Oh, that's so good to hear. And sorry to hear about your granddad, but I also found the credibility that you probably have from having worked all these positions. That gives you an edge, I would assume, in your current role.
Several of my peers are more educated, lawyers, accountants, CPAs, that sort of thing. MBAs, I don't have an MBA. What I have is experience, and I'm an operations guy. And what makes me effective in how I lead is the ability to show up at 5 o'clock in the morning with a group of drivers, you know, 10 guys and gals or 50 guys and gals, and I can look them in the eye and I can relate. I'm able to connect from a personal level. I've done the job, so I never really ask for unreasonable expectations. And I'm able to sympathize with how difficult this job is. It's one of the most dangerous jobs in the world. And, you know, we got to work together to make this safer.
As an operations person, you strongly believe that trash is not just trash, that it has value as a source of renewable energy. Can you tell us how that works?
Yeah, I mean, you can go a couple different directions. You know, when we recycle, that gives an alternative life to a product that would otherwise be landfilled. But let's talk about the landfill side first. When waste goes into a landfill, that's just the beginning of the story. When you put your garbage in a garbage can, that's the beginning of its journey. When it goes to our sites, you know, these are complex environmental, I call them eco centers, really, where, you know, the organic materials, the wood, the fibers, the pizza boxes, the dirty diapers, you know, there's a breakdown of that material that generates gas and methane. And what we do is drill a series of wells to collect that methane gas. It's got a valuable reuse or repurpose. And so when you think of a landfill, it's a big mound, but on one end, we're pressurizing it. We're pushing air into that mound. And on the other end, there's a series of suction where we're sucking the air out of that mound. So we're trying to push this gas to a collection point where we can condense it, we can clean it, and then we can use it to power either generators to generate electricity, or we can collect the compounds and generate natural gas, the type of gas you use on your stove at your home. And it's remarkable. Montreal, Quebec, one landfill that serves that community, we're installing a natural gas plant. That one plant will power over 55,000 homes in the Montreal area. Just one landfill. And we own 299 of these landfills. So you can multiply that out to see what kind of gas generation we produce. And it's pretty remarkable.
That's a staggering statistic. So one landfill can light up or give enough power for 55,000 homes.
Yeah. Now that's a large landfill. So it's all, you know, it's all on the inbound waste volume. And then it creates what we call a gas curve. As that material breaks down over time, it'll continue generate. You know, the waste we put in today will generate gas, not tomorrow. It'll start generating gas a couple years down the road. And then that gas will continue to be generated off today's volume for a certain period of time. So we're measuring how much volume's been inserted into a landfill maybe over the last few years. And then we can predict volumes to say that gas curve's going up over time.
Does a landfill reach capacity? And then what happens to the landfill?
So yeah, you know, landfills are measured on airspace. So when we site a landfill, whether it's a 200-acre site or a 1,000-acre site, there's a portion of that landfill that's below ground, and a majority of a landfill is usually below ground because that's its widest point. And then as it goes above ground, it peaks out and the airspace minimizes. Our goal is to compact as much into that permitted airspace as possible. We call it airspace utilization. So there's a whole science behind how we compact the trash. But once it's full, that site's going to continue to produce energy for the next 20 to 30 years. But we have to monitor these sites for 100 years post-closure. So we're going to monitor the gas production. We're measuring off-site leachate. We're making sure the water that comes in contact is managed and treated and captured. It doesn't run off of our property. We collect it. We either treat it on site or we truck it to a wastewater treatment plant to be treated. But we're monitoring the air, the odors, the gas, the water that comes in contact with these sites post-closure. So landfills are one of the most regulated environmental objects in our country. So, you know, they're not just dumps. They're highly regulated, high-tech eco-centers is what I call them.
You've already explained some of this, how high-tech is used in landfills to create renewable energy. What other ways does waste management use high tech in garbage?
So let's shift to recycling, if you don't mind. So we used to have dual stream, you know, back in the 80s, 90s, early 2000s, you would have to put your plastic bottles in one container, your paper products in one container, your glass in one, your metal in another. Now we've shifted to single stream. It's made it easier on the consumer. So we get higher participation, which is a great thing. The problem is it introduces contamination. You get a cart at your home. Sometimes we call it wish cycling. You get the styrofoam container. You get the child's toy. Maybe you get the lid from Starbucks that has the chasing arrows. And you're like, I'm going to throw it in the recycling because I hope it gets recycling. That's called wish cycling. But we've gone single stream because we wanted to make it easier and we wanted to collect more materials. These materials are commodities. So just like garbage going to landfill, that's just the beginning of the journey. So when you put your recycling into the container, that's the beginning. Once it goes to one of these plants, these are $40, $50 million recycling plants, and there is so much technology inside those four walls. So we're using optical sorting machines that are a series of infrared beams that, you know, as the material's passing through a belt, it's identifying where the plastic is on the belt or where the white paper is or where the brown cardboard is. And the computers are programmed to know, okay, that's exactly where the plastic bottle is. So when it gets towards the end of the line, then we use a series of pneumatics. They're almost like air pistols. They shoot the material where we want that material to go. And then ultimately it gets to the end of the line and we're getting all those brown cardboards together. We're getting all those clear plastics together. Where we can then bale it into a bale. And then we sell these bales of commodities to manufacturers who want to put recycled content into the making of their new goods. So we're really a commodities trader, And what we're really good at is collecting the material, separating the material, eliminating the contamination. And there's also a series of robotics. I think every industry right now has labor pressure. You know, you can't get vehicles, you can't even get electronic goods. And a lot of that's labor driven. There's a lack of labor. I think we're at 3% unemployment now. So what we're doing is introducing robotics. These are hard to find jobs. These used to be minimum wage jobs of manually sorting. You would have people on a line that their sole job all day was to pull pop bottles off of a moving conveyor belt. Now we have robots that we can program, and that robot will work 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And its sole job is just clear plastic, or maybe it's metal cans. But you can program it to detect certain commodities, and these robots have replaced humans. And what it's done is create higher paying jobs. So we can eliminate maybe 50 manual jobs on a sort line and replace it with 12 to 15 higher paying jobs that are more like computer programmers that are constantly watching the analytics of the waste stream and constantly adjusting the robots, because the material is dynamic. It changes hour by hour based on the collection points on the routes. We might be in one city one day, a totally different demographic the next, or it might be more commercial and industrial waste streams that produce a certain kind of content. So higher paying jobs, but less dependence on manual labor.
What can we do to minimize the wish, what did you call it? The
wish cycling.
Wish cycling, thank you. How do we as consumers minimize wish cycling? Specifically, what can be, you also mentioned about Starbucks lid having the three arrows. I would always dump the Starbucks lid in recycling. Am I not supposed to do that?
Well, so some places you can, most places you can. And what's confusing is the material recyclable?
Oh, yes, no, I've always done this, so now I have to be super careful.
The question is the material recyclable? I don't want to pick on Starbucks lids, but there's a lot of products that have the chasing arrows on them. The problem is there's no way to extract it. Once it's mixed with everything else, how do you effectively get that out, you know, when we're producing so much? So as a consumer, I'd say consume less or produce less waste. That's the objective of the consumer. I would really like to shift this responsibility to the producers. The producers that are producing these materials need to use less plastic, use more biodegradable type products, metal containers. Those are really easy to capture in a waste stream. We use magnets. We can capture any type of metal, and it can be recycled an infinite amount of times. It's more costly to package with aluminum than it is plastic shrink wrap, and it's heavier. There's a reason why packaging companies use plastic. It's lightweight, it's durable, it's flexible, but yet we're extracting oil to produce it. So I would say the consumer needs to consume less or produce less waste, but ultimately the companies that are making goods need to be more responsible in the packaging and the making of their goods. I'm going to put that on them. If you've seen the Waste Management Phoenix Open Golf Tournament, it's the largest sporting event in the world for 3 years out of every four, with the World Cup beating us the fourth year. We have nearly 1 million people attend that event, and zero goes to the landfill because we mandate that all of our vendors use recyclable products. If you're going to sell food waste, it comes in a biodegradable container. So a lot of it is the vendors you choose to do business with and demanding the packaging and their goods meet your sustainability goals.
Now I have some insight on this wish cycling. I have to be more careful about this. But help me sort out this marital conflict here. My wife believes that every can and bottle has to be washed so thoroughly. And my argument is, you're wasting so much water. What about the water wastage? So how bad is it not to rinse out a Diet Coke can before you toss it in the recycle bin?
Aluminum, I'm not too worried about. But when you have food waste, like pizza boxes, that food waste can contaminate an entire bale of paper. So your one pizza box that you put in, our machines think that's cardboard, so they mix it in with the other cardboard. That dirty cardboard is going to degrade the quality of the bale of cardboard that it gets blended with. And so, one, it's worth less value, so we're going to make less money by selling that, which hurts the whole, you know, economy. But two, the person that's buying that bale, it can cause defects in the products that they're making. If Pratt Industries is going to buy our cardboard to make new boxes to give to Amazon to ship you new products in the circular economy, it's going to degrade the quality of the next box we make of that cardboard.
It goes back to a point you made earlier. Why do the pizza companies have the recycling arrows on their boxes then?
So technically, that product, when it's created, is recyclable. It's in the process, it gets contaminated, and then it becomes not recyclable. Just like styrofoam, there are uses for styrofoam, and so styrofoam companies sometimes will put the arrows on it. But like you live in Lansing, they don't have a way to extract that material. And if they did, there's nowhere to sell it in the open market. So it's likely not going to get recycled.
Before we switch from recycling, I have one more question. How about glass recycling? I hear it's particularly challenging.
You know, that's an evolving market. 5 years ago, I would have told you glass is not good to recycle. It's really abrasive. So when it goes into our plants, imagine sandpaper on your machines all day. This stuff's going across rubber belts. It's rubbing against metal walls. It's on concrete floors, and we're moving it. So it's like we're sandpapering our machines all day. So it's so abrasive that it breaks down the machinery that we use to separate it with. It's counterintuitive. Now, beyond that, we can fix machines. We can repair stuff. So over time, it's all sustainable at a cost. There used to not be end markets. It depends on where you lived. Like if you lived in Chicago, there are companies that want to buy that material. So we have outlets. Recycling only works when you have somebody on the other end that wants to buy that commodity. I can sort any material. I can bale any material and I can store it in a warehouse. But until somebody wants that material to make a new good, it's not recyclable. So depending on where you live, what are the outlets for glass? There is a growing demand for glass. It's being used in roofing materials. It's being used in insulation. It's being used in road construction and drainage ditches. So there is a growing demand, which now makes it more recyclable in more places. We want to recycle it. It helps a lot of people and communities reach their sustainability goals. It's a heavy weight. And, you know, we usually measure recycling success by weight-based volumes. You know, how many tons did we recycle? So, you know, it's a good commodity to help out on from that aspect.
We've talked quite a bit about how robots are used in recycling and other ways high tech has an impact on recycling. But the collection of trash itself, it's a high risk job. And there is technology or some kind of robotics that's involved in collecting trash. Is that right?
I would say the trucks we use to collect your residential waste are the most high tech vehicles on the road, period. Our trucks can have up to 30 hydraulic cylinders on them. When I say hydraulics, that means things are moving. So let me back up. So when we talk about a trash driver or a waste and recycling driver, it's the fifth most dangerous job in the world. So what we've done is we're trying to engineer solutions to eliminate those safety hazards. So we're trying to go fully automated now. In the old days, you filled barrels with trash and people manually lifted them up and dumped them. Now we want you to put your content into a cart that's standardized, that we can build a mechanical lift that reaches out, grabs the container, and dumps it. So the driver doesn't even have to get out of the vehicle. Heck, even just getting out of the vehicle presents hazards. When you do it 1,000 times a day, you're going to hurt yourself. Other cars hit us. You know, in the old days, people dumped it into the rear of the truck. You know how many fatalities we have where people rear-end us and the collection drivers in between the car and the truck? Especially now that we have cell phones, it happens every year. It's happened to our drivers multiple times over the last few years. So we don't want to put our drivers in that situation. We want them inside the cab of the vehicle where they're fully protected. That's the beginning. Now let's talk about the behavioral side, where we're using AI technology and camera technology to change the way we operate to protect everybody around us. So we have two-way facing cameras in every one of our vehicles. And there's a gyro inside these cameras. These gyros are triggered by up, down, left, right, or front, back, G-force motion. So we can program the camera to say at a certain G-force threshold, trigger the camera and capture the 8 seconds prior to that event and the 4 seconds after. And so when you dynamite the brakes, because maybe you were running a stop sign and you saw a car at the last second, we capture that event. we can go back and say, what was the behavior of the driver? Where were their eyes? Where were they looking? Was there a possible distraction inside the cab, a cell phone, an earpiece, smoking a cigarette? And we've created rules and process around all those behaviors. And so if Tom Brady can watch video on a Monday to improve himself, why can't all of us watch a video to improve ourselves? And so our 50,000 employees, almost 30,000 of which are drivers, when they have one of these G-Force events, we watch the video with them and we're trying to coach out that behavior to eliminate distractions, to increase space cushioning, to make sure we stop before the stop sign and not in the middle of the intersection, those sorts of things. We also have cameras inside the hoppers of our truck. Let's go back to your contamination question you asked me earlier. So as that arm reaches out, grabs your container at your house and dumps the content into our truck, we're video recording all of that material as it drops into our vehicle. And we've programmed these cameras over time to identify contamination. This is really big in our commercial application where multiple people are using one dumpster. So if we have a cardboard dumpster, those cameras can identify plastic bags, maybe wood pallets, a chair. And then automatically we send those contamination videos directly to the customer and notify them of the types of contamination that's in their container so they can change their behavior. So we're also trying to change our customers' behavior through the use of technology. It's full circle.
You mentioned that everything we dispose of, it can be recovered in some sort of way. Is that what we mean by a circular economy? Everything comes back?
Yeah. So it's capturing goods that otherwise would be at their end of life, and it's repurposing them. So like I said, we're really good at collecting material. We're one of the largest transportation companies in the world. We collect it, and then a lot of times we process it, whether we process it in a landfill and harvest it in energy, whether we collect it as a recyclable, put it into a plant, process it into commodities, or whether it's organics waste, which is your yard waste, your leaves, or it could be your food compost. You know, I lived in Toronto for a long time. They're one of the first large communities to have home bins where you put your food waste and organics into one container. We can harvest that into energy just like we do at the landfill. As things decompose, they naturally produce gas. And that's what creates greenhouse gas. One of the largest contributors to the greenhouse gas problem we face right now is the waste we generate, which ends up ultimately going to landfills in the old model. We're trying to capture that and put it into new higher tech facilities that can capture it before it's released, and then we can reuse it. So the circular economy really is how do you take something that's been used and put it back into the economy, whether I'm putting it back in as an energy or in recycling. It's easier to visualize, you know, that pop bottle goes into our plant. We sell it to somebody who's either making a new pop bottle. They could spin it into yarn to make clothing. They can spin it into carpeting. You can make it into Trex, those boards you use on your decking material that's got plastic content. That's all mechanical recycling. What's really interesting, Prabhu, isn't the emergence now of plastic recycling, chemical recycling. So they're taking those plastics that have oils, it's an oil-based product, and they're demolecularizing that material and extracting out those molecules that through chemistry can be made back into fuels, and they're turning them into jet fuels and other type of products. So now we have mechanical recycling competing against chemical recycling. It's a really interesting technology world that we're looking at in the waste industry.
Fascinating.
Sorry, I went a little all over with that question. I started somewhere and ended in a completely different...
Oh, no, I like this demolecular idea. That's terrific. So, Aaron, you've given us many insights on what we can do as citizens, consumers, users of product. One obvious answer is use less. What are the other tips? If you can give us two or three tips that all of us can put into action, what would those be in responsible recycling?
Deal with responsible companies. It would be one. Companies that are producing responsible packaging, waste providers that are taking your content to a responsible, whether it's a recycling plant or landfill that's got a reuse purpose. Maybe educate yourself too on where does my material go. I think about the safety side of it. Eliminate distractions in your cab. You know, we have 30,000 vehicles out on the road every day, and we have the cameras, and we're coaching our people on safety. But what scares me the most is the other millions of drivers around us that are distracted. Eliminate the electronic devices while you're going down the road. That would be the number one thing I would ask for any listener that's listening to this podcast.
Terrific. Well, thank you so much for joining us. It really was a very insightful conversation. We learned a lot about technology in trash, an area that, I haven't given much thought to that, but truly it was a joy to have you on the program.
Thank you so much. I always love to talk trash. Thank you, Prabhu.
Thank you. Life Meet Tech is presented by WKAR in association with Michigan State University. Executive producer, Melanie Paul. Audio engineer, Drew Hill. And hosted by me, Prabhu David. Please subscribe wherever you're listening right now so you don't miss an episode. And I'll see you next time on Life Meet Tech.